Hello there, I'm Rob, a producer on the Black Country Talking News, and this week's edition is for the 10th of November 2021.
Hello, and welcome to the Black Country Talking News, brought to you by Sightloss charity Beacon Centre. We're pleased to confirm that the Talking News is now available via Alexa. All you need to do is say, "Alexa, play Black Country Talking News." Our Talking News service is also available via the following methods: calling 01902 213 210, visiting our website www.beaconvision.org/talking-news, as a podcast on the Black Country Radio website, on Spotify and Apple Podcasts by simply searching Beacon Black Country Talking News and hitting the subscribe button, and on your mobile or tablet device by downloading the free British Wireless for the Blind Talking News application from your App Store. We hope you enjoy this week's edition.
Thank you, Simon. Appearing this week, we have myself, Rob, Mina, Craig, Helen, Terry, John, Simon, Angela, Christine, Ed, Liz, Ian, Heather, and of course, Flashback Roger. In this week's edition, we have an update from Beacon, some local news from the Black Country. We have the quiz with Mina, news from West Bromwich Albion and Wolves, a Did You Know section from Flashback Roger, the weather, Craig's Black Country joke book, an article on accessible space travel, a workout routine, and rounding all that off with an interview with the Wolverhampton-born author, John Cronshaw. But we start, as always, with our Guess the Sound question. I'm going to play a sound clip, and all you have to do is simply guess what it is. So, here's this week's clip. Have a think on that, and Mina will reveal the answer later, alongside the usual quiz answers. We start as always then, with some local news, brought to us by Ian, Angela, Ed, Liz, and first up, it's the voice of Christine.
Councillors have been bombarded with threatening calls from anti-vaxxers over the rollout of the COVID jab. Councillor Mike Hardacre revealed that he is one of a number of elected members on Wolverhampton Council to have received abusive phone calls in recent weeks. He said one caller began ranting down the phone at him, claiming the vaccine was dangerous, while another left him with the warning, "We are everywhere." Councillor Hardacre, the authority's education chief, has been a prominent figure in encouraging take-up of the jab across the city. He said other councillors had also received calls and abusive emails in what appeared to be a clear attempt to intimidate elected members. Mr Hardacre, Labour councillor for Park, said, "If I am being generous, I would say the calls were a clear attempt to intimidate. Some of them are threatening in nature. I attempted to have a rational conversation with one of them, but they began ranting down the phone at me. Another suggested, for reasons I'm unclear about, that I was a supporter of gene therapy. I believe these people to be seriously misguided. The data is crystal clear regarding the effectiveness of the vaccine. It is the safest way for people to protect themselves and those around them, and I would urge everyone who has not been vaccinated to take the opportunity to do so."
Brownfield land is being massively underutilised for homes across the West Midlands, according to new research. Chancellor Rishi Sunak has announced plans to build 160,000 homes on 1,500 hectares of old industrial sites across the country as part of the government's levelling up plans. However, experts say the figure is only the tip of the iceberg and insist that 36,700 hectares of brownfield land could be developed for 1.3 million new homes. This includes nearly 5,000 hectares in the West Midlands, enough to build almost 180,000 homes. It comes after West Midlands Mayor Andy Street launched a review into available brownfield sites in a bid to stave off green belt development across the region. Analysis of figures from the Department of Levelling Up, Housing and Communities by real estate specialists Sirius Property Finance shows an estimated brownfield area of 4,925 hectares that could be developed. The firm say 179,071 homes could be built on such sites. Managing Director Nicholas Christoph said, "There have been long calls to utilise brownfield land in order to address the current housing crisis, and so many will have warmly welcomed the government's decision to finally do so. However, it's fair to say that the development of 1,500 hectares is really just the tip of the iceberg when viewed against the wider context of just how much brownfield land there is. Redeveloping brownfield land requires additional time, resources and budget, and so it might not be the primary focus for many house builders. But it does present a wealth of potential, and not only could it help significantly boost housing stock levels, but the value of this stock in current market conditions will be substantial."
An ambulance call handler has warned the service is on its knees as hospital delays leave staff having to play Russian roulette on who gets help and who does not. Earlier this month, West Midlands Ambulance Service revealed its frustrations with patients being put at catastrophic risk as a result of handover delays at hospitals in the region, some more than 10 hours for a single patient. In recent days, the severity of the situation was illustrated with two patients tragically dying in the back of ambulances while waiting to be seen at hospitals. While the service has warned the situation means other patients may die before they get to them. Now, a call handler for the service has spoken out on the dangers facing patients, the devastating strain on staff, and their fears for what will happen as winter takes grip. The experienced worker, whose identity is being kept secret, said the situation was worsening, describing Wednesday last week as the worst shift since they started with the trust. They explained that the level of demand meant that Category 2 calls, life-threatening incidents where people may have severe breathing difficulties, were waiting for up to 6 hours for an ambulance. Category 3 calls, involving broken bones and patients who have fallen, were facing waits of up to 20 hours. The ambulance service itself confirmed the strain facing its staff and the risk to patients, as it revealed that last Wednesday it had lost 1,179 hours across the West Midlands due to delayed hospital handovers. The service had around 405 ambulances on at the time, meaning effectively 100 ambulances, a quarter of its workforce, were out of action.
Tens of thousands of passengers are being stranded because West Midlands Railway have cancelled the last two services of the day. Figures from the last month have laid bare the amount of trains being cancelled across West Midlands. Every day last week there were cancellations, with chaos on Thursday when 31 of the final 46 services on lines through Snow Hill Station, Birmingham, did not run. The situation left passengers scrambling to get back to the Black Country by bus or taxi. Every train to the Hawthorns, Smethwick, Cradley Heath, Lye and Stourbridge from Birmingham was cancelled during rush hour, leaving commuters who traded in their cars for rail furious. A snapshot of 3 days in late October showed there were nearly 200 service cancellations, and the situation is so bad the government is coming under pressure to remove the contract from operator Abellio. West Midlands Railway has apologised, blaming a staff shortage. The Campaign for Rail is collating cancellations and warned of more problems this winter. Its chairman, Ian Jenkins, said, "Some things are unavoidable, like cable theft or a broken track, but a lot of the problem is down to staff shortages. That is unacceptable because other train companies have coped and trained up drivers during the pandemic." It was absolute carnage on Thursday night. Two-thirds of the final 46 services were cancelled, which leaves people stranded. The pattern is the last two services are often cancelled. This is just not on. The inability of people to plan or rely on train services leads to passengers walking away from the public transport when we should be doing all we can to get them to use it for both post-pandemic and environmental reasons. A spokesman for West Midlands Railway said the disruption was due to a lack of drivers.
Thousands of people turned out to the Black Country's two largest firework displays, but many were left frustrated at queues so big that some gave up and went home. A record 22,000 people bought tickets to the sold-out event at Himley Hall, and while many of those had a great time at the circus-themed event, others were left angry at the congestion around the park, lack of parking spaces, and obstructed views in parts of the grounds. It was a similar situation over at Wolverhampton Racecourse, where tickets and car parking had both sold out in advance, and many people were stuck waiting hours to travel the last few hundred yards to get in. Both events were held on Saturday night, and at Himley the bonfire was lit at 7:45 p.m. ahead of the display at 8:30 p.m. but the car parks were full by 7 p.m. Dudley Council tweeted to urge people to use the free bus services put on across the borough, but by that point thousands of people were already sat in queues and delays were also affecting the buses. Among those who spent much of the evening stuck in traffic was Joe Arnold, who reported arriving at 8:20 p.m. after 3 hours of congestion, only to be told to turn around and park on the road. At this point, there was no available parking as it was already chaotic, she wrote on Facebook. There was 8 of us in 2 cars travelling together, paid VIP ticket price, so over £100, for nothing. We couldn't get in even if we had tried, whether it be by parking on the road or by bus, because by the time we had turned round, got back through the traffic and got back to the gate, it would have all been over and time to go home. We were all so disappointed.
Now it's time to hand over to Helen, who has for us this week's Beacon Update.
Hi everyone, it's Helen, back with your roundup of all things Beacon. Firstly, have you heard Santa Claus is coming to town? Yep, we know that it's only just been Halloween, but we are definitely feeling festive here at Beacon. We've got loads happening in the run-up to Christmas and we'll be telling you all about it in the coming weeks. But, as you probably know, one of our most popular events is our Santa Run, which takes place this year on December the 5th at West Park in Wolverhampton. One of the reasons we're so excited is that it couldn't go ahead last year due to COVID, so it'll be great to see everyone back out in force again. So everyone, including our four-legged doggy friends, can sign up to support someone with sight loss. And there's a special discounted rate for running club members. You even get to take your suit or a hat for children home with you afterwards. So, what are you waiting for? Get your ticket today. Just head to www.beaconvision.org/Santa-run-2021. Next up, we're proud of our retail team all year round, but we'd like to give out a special shout out to Sarah and Nikki from our Hales Owen store, who have created an incredible handmade poppy dress in tribute to our fallen war heroes. It's a one-shouldered dress that's made entirely of red poppies, and it's currently on display in the window of our store in the town, ahead of this month's remembrance events. While we're talking about our shops, are you having a clear out at home? Well, if you are, and you can donate your good quality furniture to Beacon, you'll be helping us to support someone with sight loss. What's more, we offer free collection. If you'd like to give us a ring, you can find out some more. Just call on 01902 880 111 and press option 2. That's 01902 880 111. You can also find out more about our shops on our website, www.beaconvision.org/shops. Now, are you looking for a festive gift for someone with sight loss, or maybe even some ideas for yourself, eh? Well, from anti-spill mugs and signature guides to liquid level indicators and large print diaries, we have got something here at Beacon to suit all tastes. And what's more, well, if you buy from Beacon, you'll be helping to support our work. Prices start from under £2. To find out more, call 01902 880 111 and ask for a sight loss advisor. That's all for this week. I'll be back with another update before you know it. Thanks. Bye.
Thank you for that update, Helen. Now we head into our next block of local news. And kicking this one off, it's Liz.
New figures show 1 in 22 care home staff across the region have not yet received a single dose of the coronavirus vaccine. The figures, which were released by NHS England on October the 24th, show that of the 17,962 people working in older care homes in the Black Country in Staffordshire, around 784 people are still not vaccinated. This figure includes 114 care home staff in Wolverhampton out of 2,396 and 108 in Dudley out of 2,469. With the deadline for compulsory jabs looming on Thursday, November the 11th, care home staff will be required by law to be fully vaccinated against coronavirus to work. It could mean 4% of care staff across the region facing losing their jobs. A further 1,832 staff, or 10%, are still awaiting their second jab as of October the 24th, just over a fortnight before the deadline. Nationally, around 25,600 people working in older adult care homes, either employed by a provider or agency staff, were unvaccinated by October the 24th, with around 51,000 awaiting their second dose. Gavin Edwards, Unison's Officer for Care, said losing more staff during winter risks leaving people needing care with nowhere to turn. He said, employers and unions in social care want to see maximum take-up for the vaccine. Jab rates were steadily rising, and although the threat of being sacked will have persuaded some staff, it's also prompted many others to leave. Ministers should pause the jab deadline until at least the spring to allow even more to get their jabs, or better still, scrap it altogether.
Judges upheld the conviction and an 8-week jail term for Simon Silwood for his abusive online post. A West Bromwich Albion fan convicted of the despicable racist abuse of one of his own team's players has had his appeal against conviction rejected. Simon Silwood posted a message saying Romain Sawyers should win the Baboon d'Or, a reference to the Ballon d'Or trophy following his team's 5-0 defeat to Manchester City at the Hawthorns on January the 26th. The 50-year-old was jailed for 8 weeks at Walsall Magistrates Court in September after a district judge ruled he was not a credible witness and had meant the post to be offensive. Silwood, who had no previous convictions, then appealed against both his conviction and sentence. Hearing that appeal at Wolverhampton Crown Court last Friday, a judge told Silwood his version of events were inconceivable and, upholding the original conviction and sentence, sent him back to jail for 8 weeks, less the 6 days he had already served. Judge Jonathan Gosling, who said Silwood's decision to appeal had been unwise, told him, "You and other people inclined to mete out racial abuse must understand right-thinking people are repelled by it. We enjoy free speech in this country, and to abuse it in the way we see here requires severe punishment. Only by that means can this scourge be addressed." He added, "The message you posted that night was despicable and seen as such by all who had the misfortune to read it."
A new £3 million scheme to get people aged 18 to 24 into long-term employment in Wolverhampton has received the backing of city councillors. A meeting of full council saw an extension to the Wolves at Work Kickstart scheme being given the go-ahead. In a report to members, Duty Chief Executive Mark Taylor said, "The launch of a new Wolves at Work 18 to 24 programme is a series of targeted interventions which puts our young people at the centre of activity and urgently delivers the change needed to give them the opportunity for secure, sustainable employment, apprenticeships, education or training." An initial £3 million budget, which comes with a combination of the Recovery Reserve and COVID emergency grant, has been agreed to deliver this programme and create opportunities for our young people. Individuals need to speak to their local job centre to determine if they're eligible and will then be referred to Kickstart for a job placement. Any employers in the city who can provide placements are encouraged to email kickstart@wolverhampton.gov.uk to sign up. The funding will provide companies with £1,500 per placement to support setup costs, and the government has agreed to pay the national minimum wage for a 25-hour working week, members heard. The Wolves at Work team will help employers with the application and support with job template submissions, but companies need to register by Friday, November the 26th, and new placements need to start by March 2022.
Remembered Sunday commemorations in Dudley will go ahead this month to remember the borough's fallen heroes. The annual service and parade returns after last year's event was closed to the public due to coronavirus restrictions. Event organisers at Dudley Council have confirmed the event will go ahead on Sunday, November the 14th, and members of the public are welcome to attend. Ex-servicemen and women, along with community groups, will join a short parade that will step off from Stone Street Square at 10:25 a.m. The parade will move past the World War I Memorial on Priory Street, down Priory Road and onto Aidenham Road before coming to a halt at the Cenotaph. Reverend James Treasure will lead a Remembrance Sunday service at 10:45 a.m. and will be joined by the Mayor of Dudley. People are invited to gather on Coronation Gardens to listen to the service and can lay their own wreaths at the Cenotaph or the World War I Memorial after the service. Councillor Anne Millwood, the Mayor of Dudley, said, "It is a privilege to attend events and services throughout the year as the borough's first citizen, but Armistice and Remembrance Sunday are special events in the civic calendar and personally evoke feelings of great pride and sadness. I'm so pleased that the services can go ahead this year in a more familiar way, and I will be honoured to attend Remembrance Sunday and remember those who made the ultimate sacrifice for their country, as well as the brave men and women serving their country today."
Housing bosses have approved long-term plans to build 178 new homes on the site of a former Wolverhampton school. Proposals to redevelop land previously occupied by Northcote School, Bushbury, were given the green light after WV Living amended plans to scale the number of homes down from 196. The school in Northwood Park Road closed in 2014 and the premises was finally demolished in 2018. Following consultations with residents and council officers, work on the new estate will see a mixture of 2, 3 and 4 bedroom homes being built, with a number being kept as affordable social rental properties. Each property will be built off-site at Accord Housing's timber frame factory, Local Homes in Walsall, with a view of making them more environmentally friendly. Prior to the approval of the amended plans, 2 community engagement sessions were held, which saw a large number of people coming out in support of the scheme. However, earlier proposals also drew criticism from people concerned about the impact the new development would have on existing roads and facilities.
With another collection of questions to ponder over, up next, we have Mina.
Hello and welcome to this week's Remembrance themed flashback quiz. All the answers you need can be found later in Flashback Rogers' Did You Know feature. But for now, here are your questions. Are you ready? Question 1. How many silk poppies were sold on the first poppy day? Question 2. How is the British Legion keeping up with the times? Question 3. What does etiquette say about the leaf on a remembrance poppy? Question 4. Where in the country is the poppy factory? Question 5. In what year was Remembrance Day moved to a Sunday? And finally, question 6. Where was the first Armistice Day held? As always, I'll be back to reveal the answers later in the show. But for now, good luck.
Thanks very much for those, Mina. Now we have some more local news. And we hear first from Angela.
Dudley Council has welcomed the removal of a visitor attraction from a list of heritage sites at risk of being lost forever. Historic England has taken Dudley Castle off its at-risk register as efforts to save it for future generations was making progress despite delays caused by the COVID-19 crisis. The council-owned Grade 1 listed scheduled monument and other nearby heritage assets need around £13 million worth of work. Dudley Council leader Patrick Harley said, "We're really pleased to see our hard work being acknowledged so positively. We've been working very closely with Historic England and the zoo over the past few years to try and find the best solutions to protect the castle for future generations. This is just the start. Our published vision for Castle Hill contains more than £13 million worth of proposals to ensure the protection of heritage assets, including the castle. Thanks to a repair grant from Historic England, we have been undertaking surveys to inform on the scope and cost of works needed to repair the castle. Our next move, then, will be to target further funding opportunities to get the work done and to safeguard the castle as a landmark to be enjoyed for years to come." The castle is on land leased to Dudley Zoo.
Wolverhampton rallied together to support climate justice last weekend at a COP26 demonstration in West Park as tens of thousands marched across the country. More than 100 people gathered to protest for action against the climate change, ignoring heckles from an angry protester to listen to speeches from councillors and activists and poems written and read by Wolverhampton children. It came as tens of thousands of people protested across the country to coincide with the COP26 climate conference in Glasgow, which activist Greta Thunberg has called a greenwash and a two-week-long celebration of business as usual. Carol Hyatt, a UN-qualified climate change teacher who set up Penn Climate Action, led the Wolverhampton rally. She said, "We are asking those with power to make the same visionary decisions that the councillors who chose to buy West Park for the good of the people of Wolverhampton have made. Today, here we can say to MPs, what are you doing to stop climate change? And if their answer is nothing or very little, then we have the power not to vote for them. We are actually very powerful when it comes to stopping climate change." Mrs. Hyatt set up Penn Climate Action after her and her husband retired when he was diagnosed with cancer and she wanted to do something to make a difference. The activists led a minute silence for climate justice, voicing her plea to help southern countries who are more at risk from climate change.
Business is booming at Brierley Hill Market Hall, and site supervisors are celebrating after being presented with the Mike Holder Award for Business. The Market Hall has been in existence for 97 years and now boasts as many as 45 stallholders selling a variety of produce and goods. Supervisor Stephen Bridgewater, aged 55, from Brierley Hill, said, "The market is very much a community hub, and we have been recognised for our efforts in helping bring the community together by staging various events. We have held 1940s days, and last year had a Santa's Grotto that raised £1,577 for Dudley Council Voluntary Services. Among the other events we've helped Dudley Council to organise was the Briar Fair that was held in September. We also work with Brierley Hill Community Forum to organise events. Everyone is delighted that the market has won the Mayor's Award, which was presented to us by Councillor David Stanley."
Many shelves remain empty at one of Wolverhampton's largest supermarkets after it was hit by a power cut. Pictures taken in the supermarket on Marston Road in Penn show shelves bare and a notice apologising for the lack of stock. A Tesco spokesperson said, "We're working hard to restock the shelves as quickly as possible following a power cut and are really sorry for the inconvenience this may cause." Tesco took over the superstore last year after it was previously owned by Waitrose. An anonymous shopper said, "Luckily I only needed to pop in for some odds and ends, but I don't think I would be able to do you a family shop there because everything was so empty. It's not their fault that the power cut has happened, but they don't seem to have replenished anything." Tesco could not comment on what had to be done with stock or how much has likely lost due to the incident.
Photos of fly tippers are being shared on a new CCTV website dedicated to shaming rubbish dumping crooks. Dudley Council's You've Been Shamed CCTV wall was unveiled by bosses in the latest fight against fly tippers. The council has become the first in the West Midlands to share stills from its CCTV network online, including the faces of offenders. It aims to not only shame people into not dumping rubbish illegally, but also to encourage people to help prosecute those that do. More than £1.7 million was recently invested in upgrading the camera network in the borough, including deployable cameras to target specific hotspots. The stills from the cameras are available on a dedicated web page and are also being shared across social media. Councillor Laura Taylor-Childs, Cabinet Member responsible for CCTV, said, "The new CCTV network means there really is nowhere to hide for these criminals. The You've Been Shamed wall will hopefully not only shame people into not dumping rubbish in the first place, but also help us to prosecute offenders through the courts. The detail in the images, as people can see, is phenomenal, which will make it a lot easier to prosecute people." The You've Been Shamed CCTV wall can be found at dudley.gov.uk/you've-been-shamed.
Up next, we're an article read by Heather, all about the future of space travel and accessibility.
Have you ever wanted to go into space but thought you'd be ruled out by sight problems or another disability? If so, there's news from America about a project that is aiming to open up space travel and make it accessible to people with a range of disabilities. In October 2021, the project Astro Access gave 12 disabled people the opportunity to experience zero gravity in a flight 32,000 feet above the Earth. The flight was part of an initiative in the United States to advance disability inclusion in space, and the 12 crew had a range of mobility, vision, and hearing disabilities. The crew were drawn from a variety of walks of American life and included scientists, armed forces veterans, engineers, and artists. During the flight, they experienced weightlessness and carried out a series of tests to understand better how spacesuits and space vessels can be made more accessible for people with disabilities. The flight took off from Long Beach, California, and the journey included 15 parabolic arcs, which allowed the crew to experience short periods of weightlessness inside the cabin. During the flight, they experienced lunar gravity, Martian gravity, and zero gravity conditions. While in the air, the crew carried out a series of tests and experiments. For example, assessing the physical environment for accessibility, communicating safety procedures using multi-sensory methods, and collecting data from demonstrations and tasks completed while weightless. The mission was led by Astro Access, which is an initiative dedicated to advancing disability inclusion in space exploration. As well as providing valuable insights on the future of spacecraft design, Astro Access also aims to advance disability inclusion in science, technology, engineering, and mathematics subjects as career options. Anna Volker, one of the co-project leads of Astro Access, said, "Astro Access is sending a message to people who have historically been excluded from science, technology, engineering, and mathematics that not only is there room for you in space, there is a need for you." George Whiteside, another co-project lead for Astro Access, added, "This flight was an important milestone in our mission to open space for all. The tasks and demonstrations carried out by our crew will have a profound effect on the space industry at large, will inform the design of future space vehicles, and pave the way for future astronauts with disabilities."
Cheers for that, Heather. Now we have our final block of local news. And starting this off, it's Christine.
The end of an era is coming for a city record store as it prepares to close its doors. Oldies Unlimited has been a popular haunt for record buyers in Wolverhampton since the 1960s, having been known as a popular spot for good quality records and having hosted signings with bands such as Magnum. However, it will close the doors of its Darlington Street shop permanently on November 30th and move online. Owner Simon Malpass said the decision to close had been a difficult one, but said a number of factors had made up his mind about closing the shop. He said, "I made the decision a few weeks ago and I've been a bit up and down with it, but I've found recent circumstances have made the decision easier for me to make. One has been the change of the roads to a one-way system, meaning less buses going past the shop, while COVID has really hit us after being closed for so long. There's also family reasons as to why this is happening, and there is a part of me which is looking forward to working from home and getting my weekends back after so long." Mr. Malpass said a lot of his customers had been upset at the news of the impending closure, with many sending messages of thanks to him. He said, "I've had one person who's been coming here for so long tell me he hasn't stopped crying for 2 days since the news broke. A lot of people are upset at the news, but I think they understand why this is happening and have said they will come and see us at record fairs in the future."
A vegan bakery is set to open in Pensnet in the former home of a butcher's. Flissy's Fancy opens in the former Tomlinson's Butchers on Commonside and is the brainchild of Pensnet mum Emma George. The 29-year-old has been running her own online business for the past 4 years, creating vegan chocolate treats. With lockdown easing, she decided to take the plunge of opening her own bakery shop, Flissy's Fancy, which officially opened on Saturday, November the 6th. Shoppers will be able to buy vegan cakes, coffee, milkshakes and ice cream, all made from scratch by Emma. Emma said, "I only live around the corner and drove past the building a lot. I just looked at it one day and had a brainwave. It's a complete turnaround as we will not be harming any animals in a place that caused them so much pain." She has been a vegan for the past 4 years and hopes the business will tap into the growing popularity in veganism as people ditch animal products.
It was finger-licking good at the reopening of a KFC in Wolverhampton after a £750,000 refurbishment, which has created more than a dozen jobs.
Wolves legend Steve Bull, Pat McFadden MP and Councillor Greg Brackenridge, the Mayor of Wolverhampton, all helped celebrate the reopening of the fast food outlet in Penn Road on Friday. The new design has created a larger drive-through area and the chicken shop's 68 staff are now back at work after 6.5 weeks off. Khalid Mahmood, the general manager, said, "The refurbishment has created a further 14 jobs and by the end of the year we expect to take on a further 20 people. We are welcoming applications from those keen to join our team." The building was old-fashioned before the refurbishment, and the new design enables us to fit in more customers and increase the drive-through area. We can now cater for more visitors by car each hour. The site has been redesigned and reconfigured to provide an increased delivery and drive-through area. It is great to be reopening the doors of our Wolverhampton site. We love being part of the community and are committed to growing and benefiting the local area. We are thrilled to be bringing new jobs to the area and offering people a place to enjoy some delicious fried chicken.
A cascade of poppies has been unveiled at Dudley Castle as a moving remembrance tribute to fallen soldiers. The poppies, flowing down from the top of the castle's 11th century keep, can be seen for miles. It has been created by a huge cargo net filled with large weatherproof poppies that falls down to the cannons on the ground below. The moving display will be in place at the Dudley landmark for most of November as part of this month's remembrance commemorations. Residents have been moved by the display on social media, with Maureen Cooper commenting, "Just beautiful, a very poignant tribute. Well done to all involved with this." It has been organised by local group Dudley Remembers, who invited people to sponsor a poppy. It formed part of the celebrations for the Royal British Legion's 100th birthday. Remembrance Sunday takes place on Sunday, November the 14th, following Remembrance Day on Thursday, November the 11th.
A nurse and mother of two has taken the plunge and completed 89 minutes of cold water swimming in memory of her mother who caught COVID and died in April last year. Jill Spencer, aged 60, from Codsall, initially retired in November 2018 and decided to take up cold water swimming. Now she has returned to work and is helping with COVID vaccination clinics in Bushbury. Jill was so grateful to staff at Waterside House, a residential dementia care home in Wensfield where her mother, Mavis Farmer, was a resident, she decided to raise vital funds. She gave herself the challenge of completing 89 minutes of cold water swimming for Mavis in May and has now presented a cheque for £1,560 to the care home. Jill said, "My mother passed away with COVID in April last year, aged 89, and I decided to raise funds for the home by doing a swimming challenge. I took up cold water swimming as it was always something I had fancied doing. I decided to raise funds for the home as they were outstanding in their care, and that is an understatement." Michelle Jones, the 40-year-old activities coordinator at Waterside House, said, "Jill has done a really wonderful thing, and this is the best thing ever, as because of the COVID pandemic and restrictions, we could not hold our usual three fairs to raise funds. The money Jill has raised will be used for the well-being of residents and on activities, entertainment and trips out. She has done so amazingly well to raise the funds the way she has through her swimming challenge."
Up now, we have the one and only Flashback Roger, who's Did You Know feature, which this week is concentrating on Remembrance Day.
Hello everyone. I hope that you're all okay and that you remembered to change your clocks, unlike yours truly, who forgot and got up earlier than everybody else. Anyway, this week I found out a few details about remembrance, as it's this time of year. So here we go. Now, did you know that the Royal British Legion, formed in 1921, ordered 9 million silk versions of the flowers? They were sold on November the 11th that year. It was the first ever poppy appeal, which raised £106,000. A significant amount of money at the time, and that works out to be over 5.3 million in today's values. On average, the poppy appeal raises £50 million annually, mostly in cash. But the British Legion is trying to keep up with the times and has asked the public to donate online or by using contactless payments where it's available or when offered. And if you wear a poppy, it really doesn't matter if you wear it on the right or the left. However, etiquette has it that the leaf should be set at the 11 o'clock position to signify the hour that the guns of World War I fell silent. The poppy factory is situated in Richmond, Surrey, and is manned by disabled military veterans. It has been since its creation in 1921, where it first formed in London, and since in 1926 in Richmond. Each year, over 11 million poppies are made, 135,000 wreaths, and 1.1 million remembrance symbols. The British Legion provides every sort of support to ex-service personnel, from employment to housing and counselling for any aspect of help that's needed. Originally, Poppy Day was called Armistice Day, and was always on the 11th of November, the day that World War I ceased. In Britain, beginning in 1939, the two-minute silence was moved to the Sunday nearest the 11th of November in order not to interfere with wartime production should 11th of November fall on a weekday, and so this became our Remembrance Sunday. The very first Armistice Day was held in Buckingham Palace on the 10th of November 1919, commencing with King George V hosting a banquet in honour of the President of the French Republic. The first official Armistice Day events were subsequently held in the grounds of Buckingham Palace on the morning of the 11th of November 1919, and that included the first two-minute silence as a mark of respect. Well then, whatever the day is called, it's a fairly solemn time, but nevertheless a very important date for us all to bear in mind, I think. It always makes me remember when I was 10, and I stood with my scout troop with cold drizzle on my little legs for the service of the war memorial and wishing I was somewhere warm. Any road up, I'm off now. And this week I'll just say bye for now. So till next week, ta-ra a bit, Ta-ra!
Now we have our sportsman, Ian, giving you all the latest football news from Wolves and West Bromwich Albion.
Hello, I'm Ian, and here's your latest football news. Albion had to make do with a share of the spoils after being held to a 1-1 draw by Middlesbrough at the Hawthorns. In what proved to be an uneventful championship clash, both sides created very little in a drab first half. It was Neil Warnock's side, though, who headed into the interval ahead after Josh Coburn converted the only shot on target in the opening 45 minutes. Valerian Ismail's side improved after the interval with Grady Diangana pulling them level with his first goal of the season. But other than that, Albion's best chances arrived from Darnell Furlong's long throws, with the hosts lacking a creative spark throughout. Overall, they were the team that showed more attacking intent, with the visitors sitting deep for long spells. But it was Middlesbrough who almost won it at the end, with András Sporrar meeting a corner only to be denied by an outstanding point-blank save from Sam Johnston. Speaking after the game, boss Ismail said, "It's a frustrating afternoon for us, or a frustrating day. It started this morning with Jake Livermore when he was out, and it continued after 30 seconds with Matt Clark getting injured. So we needed again to change the players. After that, the main message from the game is that we didn't put in the performance with consistency in the game to win. 10 or 15 minutes were really good, then 10 or 15 minutes were sloppy and poor, and the problem was our quality in the last third was not good enough. We put the players in position to cross, but the crosses were too high, too short, or too long, or the last passes were too short or too long, or the last touch in the box wasn't good enough. You need that quality in such a game in the last third, and this is the reason why it was not enough to win this afternoon." Wolves' unbeaten run came to an end at the sixth attempt after a 2-0 loss away at Crystal Palace. A tight first half in which the hosts dominated possession saw Wolves adopt a counter-attacking game as they tried desperately to fashion some chances. It ended goalless, but with Wolves needing some changes to spark the game into life. In the second half, those changes only came after Wilfried Zaha had curled the hosts in front. VAR then denied Wolves a penalty before Conor Gallagher, via a big deflection, put Palace 2-0 up. Wolves huffed and puffed, looking for a way back into the game, but ultimately fell short as they tasted defeat for the first time since mid-September. Speaking after the game, boss Lars said, "We challenged ourselves to come here and continue to make a good performance, like we did against Everton," he said. "It's the challenge for this team as players and also for me as a manager. That's the dimension I want. The challenge was with ourselves to continue with a good performance, but we didn't." Crystal Palace had a massive performance against us. They were better in the duels, not just defensively, but also offensively. "This comes from the dimension I want. Me as a manager, the things I want from my team and my players. Don't be afraid of anything. And let's play our game. Don't be scared of anything. We look at our performances and results, and today it wasn't a good performance. I am not happy today, but when I look back at what we did in the last 5 or 6 matches, I cannot judge my players just because of today."
Cheers for that roundup, Ian. Now we have the weather, brought to us by Mina.
The weather for this week ahead starts off dry and settled and gets wetter as the week progresses. Temperatures are to be hovering around 11 degrees. UV levels are expected to be low throughout the week. The sunrise and sunset times are 7:32 a.m. for the sunrise and 4:14 p.m. for the sunset. For Friday 12th of November and Saturday 13th of November, we have light cloud and a gentle breeze with a maximum temperature of 12 degrees. On Sunday 14th of November, we have sunny intervals and a gentle breeze with a maximum temperature of 12 degrees. Moving on to Monday 15th of November, we have light cloud and a gentle breeze with a maximum temperature of 11 degrees. On Tuesday 16th of November, it's light rain and a gentle breeze with a maximum temperature of 10 degrees. Wednesday 17th of November brings us light rain showers and a gentle breeze with a maximum temperature of 10 degrees. And finally on Thursday 18th of November we have light cloud and a gentle breeze with a maximum temperature of 10 degrees. Now if you are going out, please don't forget to take your brolly, but if you're anything like me, don't forget to have that little dance in the rain. So that's your forecast for this week. As always, enjoy the weather.
Thanks for that, Mina. Up next, we have 10 Today. 10 Today is a series of 10-minute exercise sessions that can be done at home by anyone. New episodes will appear fortnightly.
Hello everyone, this is 10 Today, a 10-minute set of exercises to do at home to help keep yourself active. Before we get to today's presenter, a couple of housekeeping points to note. The 10 Today project is funded by the Big Lottery and Sport England, and when you're doing the exercises, it's important that you don't push yourself too far, and by taking part, you agree to 10 Today's terms and conditions. You can read these terms and conditions at tnflink.uk/10T, and the 10T is the digit 1, the digit 0, and the letter T. And please remember that you agree to take part at your own risk. Today's exercises are brought to you by Terry, and here he is.
Hello everyone, welcome to 10 Today, broadcast number 2. This is a short 10-minute physical activity routine which will get you moving and stretching. It's great for your health, including improving your balance and building up your strength. Just take it at your own pace. There are plenty of options. If an exercise feels too much, just take it easy and have a break. All the exercises can be done either stood up or sitting down, so just do whatever feels good for you today. We want you all to do this exercise safely. You are responsible for monitoring how you are feeling throughout the session. If you feel any discomfort or pain, for example, if you feel unwell or dizzy or experience palpitations, then please stop and seek medical advice. Please remember you agree to take part at your own risk. If remaining seated, at least to begin with, you should have your feet flat on the floor. It would be ideal if you can use a hard chair that you can sit upright in, which could be a dining chair, preferably without arms, which can get in the way of some exercises. Okay, if you are stood up, just step your feet hip-width apart, relax your shoulders, and stand up nice and tall, and take a couple of deep breaths. If you're sitting down, place both feet firmly on the floor, keep your back straight, relax your shoulders, and take a couple of deep breaths. In and out, in and out. So, the first exercise is called Reach for the Stars. So raise both your arms up to the sky or stars. When at the top, raise up onto your toes. You can raise up onto your toes if you are sitting or standing, and then lower down both your feet and your arms, pushing down with your palms down. So keep going, raising your hands up, then up on your toes, then lower down your hands and feet. And keep going, feeling that nice stretch through the upper body and shoulders. So just a couple more now. That's great. Well done. Next up, Strike of the Cobra, a wee bit of martial arts. So with a strong stance, standing up tall with your fists clenched in front of your chest like you are a boxer, punch your right hand straight out in front of you and return. Then with the same hand, punch it to the left side so your arm crosses your body and reaches towards the ceiling. So you're punching up and across. And return. Now with your left hand, punch straight out and return. Then punch to the right side so your arm crosses your body, reaching for that ceiling again. Try not to worry with the logistics on this one. Just energetic punching is good. Keep going now with alternate hands at your own pace. So punching straight out in front of you and then to the side, pointing your fist up to the ceiling. This is great for strengthening those arms. We should all be feeling nice and warm now. Now we have the side stretch, standing or sitting up straight. Raise your right arm high, straight up to the ceiling, with your palm facing up. Place your left hand on your hip, and then gently lean over to your left side, feeling that stretch all along your right side, and return back to the center. Now, lower your right arm and place your right hand on your hip, and raise your left hand straight up to the ceiling, and lean over to the right, and feel that stretch all the way down your left side. Now keep alternating, feeling that nice stretch down your side. So arm up, and lean over, and repeat. Great work. Well done. Next up is swing back. If you're standing, keep your legs straight and your feet facing forward. If you're sitting, keep your feet flat on the floor. So lift your elbows out to the side, raising your hands chest height, and then straighten out your right arm, keeping your left arm bent, and gently swing your right arm back behind you, looking over your shoulder. Then gently swing your right arm back to the center and straighten out your left arm, keeping that right arm bent, and gently swing your left arm back, looking over your shoulder, then swing back to center. Try for a smooth swinging action from side to side. So once again, swing your right arm gently back with your left arm bent, looking at your right arm as you swing back, then swing back to the center and bend your right arm and gently swing your left arm back and then return. And repeat. So you're just moving side to side with a nice, smooth, fluid movement. Swinging alternate arms back, nice and gently, feeling your back rotate as you move side to side. Just a couple more now. This is a great one for trunk rotation. Next, if you're standing, you might want to be near something you can hold on to help with balance. This one is a leg raise. If you're standing, lift one leg with your bent knee up to hip height and return your foot to the floor. And if you're sitting with a bent knee, lift your leg slightly higher than hip height and return your foot to the floor. Now do the same with the other leg, bend the knee, lift up to hip height and return. Now keep going on alternate legs, so really just lifting those legs up. Next is slowly does it. These exercises are slightly different if you are sitting or standing. If you're standing, remember to keep your back straight and keep your feet facing forward, and try not to let your knees move in front of your toes. So if you're standing, bend at your knees slightly and hold, and then bend your knees all the way down to your lowest point and hold, and then straighten up your legs again. So you're just moving halfway, holding, moving down to your lowest point, holding, and then coming back up. Keep going. If you're sitting, just straighten out your right leg right in front of you and hold briefly, feeling that nice stretch down your leg, then return your foot to the floor and repeat on the other side. Whichever variation you're doing, you're working your legs. If you're standing, you're also working your bottom. Okay, so keep going, always remembering to keep your back straight. So for those standing, bending knees halfway, hold and then all the way down and then up. And sitting, raising alternate legs. Slow and controlled is more challenging and rewarding. And just a few more. Well done. Now, it's push up to the moon. So we want a nice soft bend in your knees and a strong stance for this one. Then bend your arms so both hands are at chest height. Then push both your hands up to the ceiling on your right, like you are pushing up to the moon. Then sweep your hands back down and to the left, pushing both your hands up to the ceiling, again on your left. And now keep going. So you're just making a nice big U-shape with your hands, pushing up to the moon on either side. When you sweep your hands at the bottom of the U, you can bend over slightly to make that sweeping movement bigger. Keep going with that nice dynamic shape, pushing up to the moon on each side. So again, if you're standing, you might want to be near something to help with balance. This exercise is called kick across, and you're just standing on one leg and kicking the other leg straight across to the opposite side. So kick your right leg to the left side, keeping it straight, and return and do the same on the other side. So now keep going, kicking that leg across from side to side. You should feel that work in your legs. And again, slow and controlled is more challenging here. Keep going for a couple more. Good work, well done. Next up is full circle. Raise both arms straight up above your head and then sweep them round together to the right, down to the bottom, and back up to the top, making one big circle all the way back up to the top, and keep going, swinging one big circle to the right. Just a couple more in this direction. Good work. Now we're going to do exactly the same, but in the opposite direction. So keep making those nice big circles. It's a great workout for your shoulders, this one. Just a few more now. One more. Great job. Now we really all should be feeling warm. If you're a little out of breath, that's a good thing. It means you've been working. If you're not a little out of breath, can you work a little harder next time? Well done. We're nearly finished. We'll just finish off with a nice stretch and cool down. So we're going to start with a hamstring stretch. So feet facing forward, step forward with your right foot, placing your foot out in front of you with your foot flat on the floor. Keep the right leg straight, then bend your left leg and put your hands on your hips and just lean your chest forward gently. Whether you're sitting or standing, you should feel a nice stretch down the back of the right leg. And now hold for 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, and 1, and finish. Then return to an upright position and swap your legs over. So keeping your feet facing forward, this time step forward with your left foot, placing your foot out in front of you with your foot flat on the floor. Keep this leg straight, then bend your right leg and just lean the chest forward gently. Again, feeling that nice long stretch at the back of the left leg. And hold for 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, and 1, and finish. And the final stretch, hugging a tree. Just hold your arms out in front of you, just like you are hugging a tree, directly in front of you. Your arms form a nice circle in front of you, and then cup your hands together, putting one hand in front of the other, and push your hands together, feeling that nice stretch across your shoulders and arms. And now hold for 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, and 1, and finish. Now sit up or stand up and return to that nice, relaxed posture we had at the beginning. Brilliant! So that was all the exercises. We hope you enjoyed them. Just to finish off, shaking out, just shake those arms and hands and then legs and feet. Great work, everyone. Doing 10 today just 3 times a week can have great health benefits. It's fun, and you'll simply feel better. So do keep going. Thank you for listening.
Thanks for that, Terry. I feel really limbered up now. Now we have our joke book, brought to us by Craig.
Hello, I'm Craig. I'm going to tell you some jokes from your Black Country joke book. How do you stop moles digging in the garden? Hide all the shovels. Here's another one for you. There's a fellow in Tipton who's so lazy that when his missus asked him to go out and see if it was raining, he replied, "Why don't you call the dog in and see if he's wet?" And finally, that man came up to me and hit me over the head with a vase and he went to pound. I said, "Don't you mean kapow?" He said, "No, I've got China in my hand." I'm Craig, and that was my Black Country joke book.
Well, cheers for those, Craig. Now we get the quiz answers, brought to us by Mina.
Hello, and here are your answers for this week's remembrance-themed flashback quiz. Are you ready? Question 1. How many silk poppies were sold on the first poppy day? And the answer, 9 million. Question 2. How is the British Legion keeping up with the times? And the answer here is by accepting contactless payments. Question 3. What does etiquette say about the leaf on a remembrance poppy? The answer, it should be placed at the 11 o'clock position behind the flower. Question 4. Where in the country is the poppy factory? And the answer is Richmond, Surrey. Question 5. In what year was Remembrance Day moved to a Sunday? And the answer here is 1939. And finally, question 6. Where was the first Armistice Day held? And of course, it was Buckingham Palace. How did you do? Great, I hope. But if not, there's always another chance to have a go next week. Now, did you get the answer to this week's Guess the Sound question that Rob asked at the start of the show? Here's one more chance to hear it before I tell you the answer. The sound you just heard was a recording of a woodpecker. Now, to end this week's edition of the Black Country Talking News, we have an interview with a Wolverhampton-born author, John Cronshaw, who has recently released a new book that's titled Black Death Survival.
I'm speaking today with the author John Cronshaw. John Cronshaw is a science fiction and fantasy author from Wolverhampton, known for his epic fantasy Ravenglass Chronicles series and post-apocalyptic Wasteland series. Based in Morecambe, John has a PhD in the history of art, having focused on the life and work of the American sculptor Jacob Epstein, and he has also written for local and national newspapers across the UK. His latest book, which has just been released, is titled Black Death Survival, a post-apocalyptic thriller set in various locations across England and Wales that find themselves enveloped by a resurgence of the killer plague. Thanks for joining us on the Black Country Talking News, John.
Hey, nice to meet you. Great to be here.
Great to have you. Would you say that biography covers everything, or have I missed anything important that you'd like to ask?
It doesn't cover everything, but I mean, it's a few lines, isn't it? But I think you've got the main bits, yeah. The Black Death is the new one, and then, yeah, Wasteland series, I did that. There's also a series I did called Blind Gambit, which is about visual impairment and video games and things like that. So, yeah, I think that's pretty thorough.
Okay, great. Thanks for adding that. I haven't actually come across that other series you mentioned. What was that again? The name of that one?
It's called Blind Gambit. So I did a book that was about me basically coming to terms with visual impairment, and also it's a bit of a love letter to video games that I love growing up. So bit of a weird one. Doesn't sell very well.
Is that where you get a lot of your inspiration from? Just sort of your everyday experiences, or where do you find your inspiration from for your work?
Yeah, I mean, I love actually getting out there, and I think you miss a lot of stuff because now a lot of authors just do research online or in books or whatever. I find I've come up with my best ideas from going and have a look around a ship, going exploring a castle, looking in a museum, finding out little details, getting a feel for places. Like, everywhere feels different in terms of just how the air is. And you're not going to get that in a book, You're not going to get that looking at a YouTube video. So it's, yeah, I this is the thing I have missed with this pandemic is I feel like I'm in a bit of a drought creatively at the minute because I haven't been able to do that properly. I've not been able to go and explore and just look around all these places. So I'm hoping that, as this thing kind of gets better, that I can get back into that again and get some more new ideas.
So you're one for absorbing sort of environments and ideas and places to get your ideas rather than necessarily planning out, very point to point.
when you're planning your works?
I mean, I do plot, I do plan, but I need to, like, I know a lot of writers that write down every idea that they get. I don't. I go with the ideas that are sticky. If I can't shake something in my head, I think, okay, there's something there with that character or that place or something like that. Like, I did a book called Wizard of the Wasteland, which is the first one in my Wasteland series, and the idea for that came to me in a dream, which sounds a bit cliche, but I had this dream about this guy pretending to be a wizard, kind of showing off kind of pre-fall technology and claiming it's magic. And that was the start for this series. Mm. And so little things like that where I can't shake the idea, that's what I get into, that's what I start writing. And then I'll come up with ideas from that. I mean, this last fantasy series I wrote called The Ravenglass Chronicles, that was, I saw it a bit like, you know, like a concept album, like a prog rock band might have done in the 70s, of like, I want to do a series of books that is based on every card in the major arcana of the tarot. So I did a 21 book series that was, each of the cards were, I kind of drew from the imagery and the ideas in each card to kind of inform what the story was and where it'd go and things like that. So, yeah, it's just, I think it's all around you. The ideas are all around you, and you've just got to kind of pay attention and be open to it. And I think when you are, you start noticing more and more details and things. So, yeah.
Yes, definitely. I mean, I've always found that myself, you know, being open to experience and being open to not putting up artificial walls and just allowing ideas to flow over you is tends to be, for me as well, and I'm doing creative practice as well, tends to be the way to go forward as well. You said you do plot and plan, but I find in my own work I cannot do that. I have to be even more sort of free flowing. But you know, everyone has their own ways of doing things, and it's fascinating to always hear how people come up with their ideas. It's funny you mentioned the dream idea that you can't. Yeah, you had an idea come via dreams, because you know I myself, it's not about me, but I myself had loads of ideas come that way, and it's really hard to sort of express that to people that aren't necessarily creative. That's the way ideas arrive. There's no strict, I mean, I'm sure you agree, I'm sure that there's no strict way you can get to an idea. It just has to bubble up and become a form, almost magic. Yeah.
Well, I think there is. I think there's some, like, you know, I think it was Freud who talked about the idea of our unconscious mind. It's like most of what we're aware of is just a little bit of what is actually going on. And I find that, you know, when you have an idea or trouble, the phrase is sleep on it. You know, you sleep on it and then you can come up with a better idea or whatever. And I think that is to do with the idea that our imaginations are kind of powered by sleep. And when we've not got the everyday conscious thing going on in our brains, we can kind of get out of our own way, and then new ideas come and new connections are made and things like that. And that's where the interesting stuff happens. That's where the magic happens. So.
Yeah, exactly. I totally agree with that. Wants to ask us, what is on your first early experiences with literature, your first sort of engagement with it? Have you got any memories of that?
I mean, for me growing up, I mean, we didn't have a lot of money in my house, but books were always there. I have distinct memories of my dad, you know, when he'd get paid from working at Lawnmower Shop in Bilston, he'd come back and he'd buy me a Thomas the Tank Engine book. So he'd bring those home and then we'd read them. And then getting a bit older, you know, Roald Dahl books, just like really loving The Witches and The Iron Man by Ted Hughes and Chronicles of Narnia, like The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, I think is probably why I'm writing fantasy today. Yeah, I mean, that book just had a massive impact on me. And just the fact that you can tell these stories that are, you know, that, I don't know how you put it, it's like they, even though they're in these fantasy worlds, there's like a real truth to them. Do you know what I mean? It's something like a deeper level of truth than just what's around us. So, and that's always struck me, that, you know, these stories seem almost more real than reality. If that makes sense.
Yeah, no, exactly. Because, you know, science fiction and fantasy as a whole is sort of where ideas are explored, I find. And so I was going to ask you on that sort of point, actually, why is it that you think that genre gets disparaged generally by sort of like literary sort of elites, as it were? Because science fiction and fantasy is, you know, it's popular, it's very popular, but nevertheless, it's, you know, not taken necessarily as, you know, seriously as it, but personally,
it's not for those people. That's the thing. I don't think you can take any genre of anything and go, that's a good genre, that's a bad genre. You know, it's like there's great stuff in every genre. There's a lot of bad stuff in every genre. And I think the people who dismiss anything, you know, that says to me more about them than anything else. Like I don't distinguish between a book by Kurt Vonnegut and Ian McEwan or something. I think they're both great novelists who do really good things, but they're doing different things for different people. And it's like you for me anyway, I like to write for my readers. I don't write for me like I did when I first started. It was about my ego and the stuff was rubbish. You know what I mean? It was rubbish. And then when I started thinking about, okay, what is entertaining? What do people like? What would entertain me? And then thinking about it as almost like a service, you know what I mean? That's when I started to have people like my stuff. That's when people started buying my stuff. And now I do this full time. And I've been able to do that because I listen to readers and I try and write for them rather than for me. So, yeah, going back to your thing, it's like, who cares what the genre is? It's like, there's great stories in every genre. There's bad stories in every genre. And if you've got a problem with that, that's your problem, not the reader's.
Yeah, definitely. Going back to your sort of first sort of experiences with literature again, I was just going to ask, was you a frequent sort of visitor to local libraries? And you know, how do you feel about the sort of the conditions of libraries at the moment?
I'm a passionate lover of libraries. I think libraries were great when I was growing up. As I say, we didn't have a lot of money, but I could always get to a library and get a book out. I think libraries are just the it's difficult at the minute just because of the pandemic stuff, but I think libraries need to do more to help communities. I think they're a community hub, and I think they should be doing more to encourage future writers and to support local writers, even if these writers aren't contracted to a corporate publisher, or even if it's someone who's written a memoir who doesn't even intend on publishing it. I think seeking those writers out, engaging with them, becoming something more than just a place where they'll look on a catalogue and go, oh, sorry, your book's not in our catalogue. You know, there's more imagination, I think, that's needed with it. But I think they're just so necessary and so important. And that's kind of why I get a bit passionate about libraries, to be honest.
Well, yeah, I think that is the case, making them more community hubs and being more focused on that and just being necessarily a place for catalogue for books. Because then, you know, with the current sort of market with Amazon and the way that they dominate and, you know, other major book chains, the library, you know, there could be an argument saying, oh, we don't need libraries anymore because people can access books easily at home now. But as you've put forward, maybe, you know, the community hub aspect is the bit which needs to be sort of focused on a bit more.
I remember I used to go to the Long Knoll Library in Wolverhampton and, you know, I used to be able to go and book the Amstrad CPC 464 for half an hour and play on that. I mean, it'd take most time, would be loading the game, but
of course, yeah.
I still get to play on it and you know, the do Lego clubs and things like that in our local libraries in Morecambe. So little things like that where you're giving more to the community, I think that's the future libraries. I think that, you know, being places where people can go and it not be about just the books.
What I didn't mention earlier in the biography was that you have sight loss. And what I wanted to ask was, when you were at libraries, did you find that they were able to sort of serve you better, basically help you with that condition while you were there, have the right resources for you to sort of be able to still engage with the literary world?
Well, for me, the condition I've got is called retinitis pigmentosa, which I'm sure a few of your listeners will be familiar with, and it's progressive. So when I was a teenager and, you know, a kid, I didn't notice it. I didn't really have it.
Yeah.
So this has progressed. I mean, now I've got, I mean, my left eye is just shot and I've got about 5% in my right eye, central vision. So I can't read stuff anymore in print. So a lot of my reading is either done on a Kindle or through audio. I mean, I devour audiobooks. Because libraries are now doing things with things like Overdrive and Borrowbox and things like that, there is the opportunity now for kind of visually impaired users to get access to things that they might not have been able to access before. But yeah, I just think, you know, there's probably some work that needs doing. You know, maybe, I mean, I've never enjoyed large print books, so I don't know whether I'm the only one. You know, maybe a lot of people do, I don't know. But I think, because like with the RNIB stuff, the way that used to be, you know, you'd get a player and things like that. So maybe there's an opportunity there for libraries to maybe do a bit more to engage with the audio side or different formats and things like that to make it easier. But yeah, I don't know. It's a difficult one because I think that there's so many different disabilities and impairments that there can be that, you know, you can't necessarily cater to everyone in a quality way. And I think that, you know, something like the RNIB do it really well. So,
yeah,
you know, maybe they just need to direct. Like, I didn't hear about the RNIB stuff through the libraries, and maybe that should be a thing that they mention, perhaps.
Yeah, get some more outreach so that the libraries know what other services there are for people. Connect the charities a bit more so they can sort of pass that message on that you know, people aren't isolated or disconnected just because you know, their sight loss condition. I was going to ask you about audiobooks. Are your books put into audiobook form? Do you record those yourself or do you have someone else record those?
I do not record them myself. No, I've got a professional, you know, or any books that I've got an audiobook of have used professional narrators. The only ones I've got so far are my Wasteland books and let me think, the Survivor one is in production at the moment, but I don't know when that will be coming out. Now with my Ravenglass set, I want to get an audio thing done of that, but it's massive. It's like 400,000 words. So I need to either get it through a traditional corporate publisher like Podium or Tantor or someone like that, or I need to get enough together to produce it. And that might mean doing a Kickstarter or crowdfunding because, you know, it's usually somewhere in the region of $300 to $400 per finished hour.
Yeah.
So I think that'll be about 40 hours. So, yeah, that's going to be a lot of money.
Yeah, it can't be easy trying to get audiobooks done as a, you know, independent indie author because, as you say, the financial sort of cost to that. But then, as you say, the fact that there is crowdfunding now, at least there's hope that, you know, get more of your sort of work.
And there is, like, the option I use for my books is I have a royalty split with the narrator. So we got it set up so that, you know, ACX, which is a company that does it, automatically pays both of us. So, yeah, it's actually quite easy. But obviously, half the money is going to the narrator, which when you're advertising and things like that, that kind of makes it more difficult to make a profit.
Of course, yeah. Can you get on yourself with sort of AI voices and sort of artificial voices reading, like voiceover apps when it comes to, you know, listening to a long form piece of work? Or I know some people can't necessarily don't feel the emotion coming through obviously an AI voice, which is, you know, understandable.
Yeah, I find I have no problem listening to nonfiction with a robot voice, but when it comes to fiction, it's not there yet.
Just loses that sort of warmth that you get from a sort of real human voice doing it.
Yeah. And especially, I mean, there's a audiobook I listened to recently, which is called Piranesi by Suzanne Clark. And that is best audiobook performance I've ever heard. And because of the voice acting in that, it took it to another level. And it's the same with, what was it, Kurt Vonnegut's Slaughterhouse-Five. Like, the audiobook of that is narrated by Ethan Hawke. And the way he does it, there's a phrase that repeats throughout, which is, so it goes. So if something dies or, you know, there's something tragic happens, there's just, and so it goes. But the way he says that every time, it's a little bit of a different intonation, different tone, and it just gives it a new meaning, which if it was read by a, you know, an AI thing, you wouldn't get that. So I'm all for good narration, for sure.
Well, yeah, I was going to say, have you noticed, I don't know how what your sort of historical experiences of audiobooks are, but with a growing interest in them at the moment, and, you know, loads of celebrities trying to get involved, have you noticed that then, that the audio recording quality has got better over time?
Yes, definitely. And it's really hard to listen to some of the audiobooks that were, let's say, produced in the mid to late 90s that just, they're obviously recorded for tape and they just don't, I don't know, just the quality isn't there. And the one that bugs me is Lord of the Rings. They've still not produced a new audiobook of that since the 90s and it sounds terrible. I'm hoping that...
But you'd have thought someone would have done that one by now.
I mean, it must just be a licensing and rights issue or something like that. But yeah, it needs doing. And yeah, so when I hear the older audiobooks, they're fine. But I think we're almost like in a golden age of audio at the moment. I think there's some really good quality, like just the best quality stuff coming out at the moment. Really good voice actors and really good quality mics and things. So yeah,
and it's amazing the amount of sort of amateurs that you get doing it. They're doing it really high quality off their own back, you know, in podcast forms or even doing their own sort of literature, just direct to podcast. Yeah, I think of Welcome to Night Vale podcast comes to mind in particular. But
like Scott Sigler does a lot of that stuff as well, and yeah, really good.
So if we come to your latest release, Black Death Survival, that seems to clearly rip off the current real-world experience of the pandemics and the current ongoing situation of COVID-19. Had the idea for the story existed prior to the current pandemic, or was it very much inspired by, you know, the current lockdown experience we've all had to go through over the past couple of years?
Okay. I wrote this book, most of it in, October, November 2017. So it started off as a collaborative trilogy with two other authors. And the idea was is we'd write this gritty post-apocalyptic thing set in the UK. And I wrote my contribution to it. I think I'd finished by the end of 2017. And then one of the co-authors ghosted us for a while. Going, it's coming, never arrived. And then, so me and the second co-author, we scrambled to make it right. And, you know, we added loads of scenes and did stuff. And then he, because of everything going on in his life, he ended up pulling out. And then with 2020, it just didn't work. So, you know, I was dragged along basically for a few years with this book. This should have been coming out several years ago as a trilogy. And instead, I got all the stuff that I did for it, rewrote it, and did a fresh edit and everything. And then it does seem a bit creepy now going back to it. Just how close some of the things are and how there's a lot of craziness in there. And it's like, is that... Like, I thought that was crazy at the time. And now looking at how things have gone, it's like, is that actually that crazy? I don't know.
Absolutely. I mean, I've read about probably 3/4 of it so far, and I'm going to probably finish reading the rest of it later tonight. And one thing I pick up very much on it is there's very much a claustrophobic sort of feel to it, which very much echoes the sort of lockdown situation that we had. And as you say, if you wrote that in 2017, that's very sort of, as you say, prescient to sort of why most people sort of felt around 2020, if not necessarily the exact themes that obviously go on in the exact story in the novel, the feeling certainly seems to be sort of on the money.
Yeah, I did a kind of a spin-off story, like a shorter novella called Black Death London. And that, for me, is just too close to the bone. That's too chilling. I don't like it. Because that's set around a shadow health minister trying to use the pandemic as a way to seize power. And it's just like, I wrote it as a bit of I wanted something a bit like The Thick of It meets The Walking Dead. You know, I used to be a political reporter and ended up working for a shadow politician. So it's given me some great ammunition for that story. So it feels too real. Maybe it's just because of my experience, but
Well, again, as you said, that's getting as much as you can from your real life to sort of enter your fiction, but too real by the sounds of it. So, it sounds very interesting. It sounds exactly the sort of thing I would personally like to read. So, thanks for speaking with us today. And if people want to find out more about you and your latest works, where can they do that?
You could go to johncronishaw.com. That's JohnCronishaw. I'm on Facebook, facebook.com/johncronishawauthor. You can also find my YouTube channel, which is youtube.com/John Cronshaw Author. And for audio listeners, I do a weekly author diary podcast. So if you just search for John Cronshaw's Author Diary, wherever you listen to your podcasts, you'll be able to find it there.
Now, so that is a great podcast. I've been listening to it myself, and I look forward to hearing more from that. So thanks for having me on the Black Country Talking News. John, it's been great to hear from you.
Thank you. And good luck. Good luck with the show.
Cheers. Thank you very much.
So that's it for another edition of the Black Country Talking News. A reminder to our CD listeners who have received CDs in padded envelopes that you don't need to send anything back to us. If you have a sight loss tip or someone you would like to wish a happy birthday to, just say hello to. Maybe even a poem or talking book you would like reviewed, then please get in touch with us at the Beacon Centre. Call 01902 880111. Email bctn@beaconvision.org or write to us at the Black Country Talking News, Beacon, Wolverhampton Road East, Wolverhampton, WV4 6AZ. We look forward to hearing from you. Thank you for listening, and thank you to all our supporters, donators and volunteers who without their support would be unable to run this free service. Please note the information and views expressed in this recording does not necessarily represent the views of Beacon or Talking News and were accurate at the time of recording. Mentions of goods and services does not imply endorsement, and whilst every care is taken to supply accurate information, Beacon and Talking News do not undertake liability for any errors. So it's goodbye from all of us, stay safe, have a good week, and we look forward to bringing you next week's edition of the Black Country Talking News. Ta-ra!